Welcome to eHealth Learning, inspiring professionals worldwide.
So warm welcome to this evening's webinar with Joanne Overson, the Bioemotional Breath, which is an introduction to her three-part course that's coming very soon. Joanne's done lots with us and we're really happy to have her back and addressing the topic of the breath in this strange time that we're all living in with respiratory fear and symptoms from some people and many others. So Joanne, welcome back to Embodied Health Learning. You also just did a really great couple of webinars for our members on embodied archetypes. And what was the other one?
Sacred geometry.
Talking about fascia, biotin, integrity, and how we form. And
I've just realized I've left my model on the shelf. Don't go away. I'll be here.
Okay.
I'm right by you.
So if you're joining us in Zoom, thank you. I can see lots of familiar names in our list. You can use the chat box if you want to ask questions or the Q&A. If there's lots of chat and your question is urgent, or let's put it in the Q&A, because then I can it will just stay there. And if you're on Facebook, you can comment in this live below and I will be checking Facebook as well. So yeah,
can I make a couple of suggestions? One is that if you've got a question in the chat, put three question marks next to it and it'll catch my eye as well, so I might even never know, I might get ahead of you, Julian. Ooh. And the other thing is this course is already written and done, obviously, in advance. However, I am extremely mindful of providing people with information they want rather than information I think they need. So please, anybody that's intending to do the course or considering doing the course, if you've got burning questions about the breath or aspects of it that you don't understand or would like more information on, please put them in the chat and I can incorporate them. Even if I don't answer them now, then I can take them into the presentation and maybe shift emphasis a bit, because I'm very keen to provide people with ideas tonight for thinking about the breath, perhaps in a slightly different way or in a way that deepens and confirms something that you're doing. And I'd love to know what that is. So any feedback you have, please note that even if I don't respond immediately, I will.
Yeah, we'll save the chat, won't we? And I'll send that to Joanne. So yeah, everything will be get collected. Yeah, and as these other courses have been during this time, it will be a three-part series. The registration link is in our events or on embodiedhealthlearning.com/courses, or find courses in the navigation and you can sign up there. And it's £60, which is definitely at least half price of all our teachers, their normal price for running courses. So we're making it as accessible as possible. And if you're a member, you can get 20% off. If you're not a member yet, you can join for a year and get Joanne's course for free. We still pay the teacher the same amount, so you're not shortchanging Joanne. You can sign up for a year and enjoy all the past webinars.
I was doing it for the money, Julian. We all would, wouldn't we? Go home. Yeah,
so tonight we're going to discuss the breath, and Joanne's had a look at the webinar I did a few weeks or months ago, and Joanne's going to be bringing a whole different perspective. I was looking more at the work of Leon Chaito and breath assessment, and you're going to discuss the bioemotional breath from a biotensegral point of view, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to be very clear about a couple of things, and that is that, you know, my colleague John Sharkey and I both teach the anatomy and the various aspects of physiology and neuroscience and integrated manual therapy and integrated movement practices from a point of view of, as John coins it, 21st century anatomy. And that is essentially a paradigm shift from what we might call 20th century anatomy. And the huge difference from one to the other is the non-linearity that we look for to explain. Now, what do I mean by that? So in classical anatomy, we look at specific muscles and their specific functions and their origins and insertions and how they attach to the different bones, and we name the bones, and we do what I call a name and blame routine, which is not a negative thing at all. It's that you know where you are in the body and you know which muscles are attached to which bones, and the assumption being that that's how we move, through the muscles contracting and pulling the bones at their origins and insertions. From a 21st century point of view, there's a few problems with that notion. And that is that it omits the fascia, which is a very obvious statement probably to most people on this webinar, because I think we've all done enough work together now to know the fascia is a very huge and important shift in understanding over the last 10, 20 years. But what I find when I'm working with people is that we've naturally inherited this understanding of function as a correlate with the action assigned to each muscle in the body. And from that assignation of what that muscle does, therefore those movements happen. And we have a similar kind of linear functional pathway to explain breath. And then we seek to integrate breath and motion as if we've got this block called the breath and this block called motion, and we somehow have to put them together in anatomical and physiological terminology. And one of the things that does is gives us linear maps of linear processes. And it puts us in a very intellectual realm. All of it's very useful. I'm not denigrating it for a single minute. It really helps if you need help to know where the pain is, and it gives people clues to finding out what's going on, and it's important data. And I have to say, in that gap side point, that the webinar that you did with Leon Chaitow and using his work was of course absolutely brilliant. He's known as the breath doctor in some quarters, and I had the great good fortune and pleasure of working at the National Training Centre in Dublin, teaching on the higher diploma there, where he and John Sharkey developed European neuromuscular therapy. And so it was my pleasure to be teaching the same faculty and working with a kind of a different approach, which at first was quite daunting because it seemed as if I was challenging what Dr. Chaitow was saying, which I wouldn't dream of doing. And what I realized for the students and for myself was that this is a very expansive way of including all of that, but moving not necessarily beyond it, but from a different perspective, that the biomechanical functioning of the body and the named and blamed muscles for their actions and the data-based knowledge of the breathing rate and the saturation and the calculating that we do is a very intellectual approach to a non-intellectual process. Moving, breathing are not intellectual processes. So the problem is, it's a bit like trying to measure the depth of a pond with a ruler or a protractor. You're kind of like, and imagine you're trying to measure how much water there is in the pond with the ruler. Does that make sense? I mean, of course it doesn't. You sit there looking at me like, well, she's bonkers. But she's actually not that bonkers, because when we work as, and I'm assuming everyone on this call is either a manual or a movement practitioner, and if not, they're interested in those fields and beyond them to the healing arts, that breathing is living. They're very tightly woven, because we've stopped breathing when we die, or the mark of dying or death is not breathing anymore. And that brings us into another realm of understanding, which is the realm sometimes referred to as spirit, as in respiration, respiriting the body. And I'm a yoga teacher and yoga therapist, and that aspect of yoga as a part of Ayurveda is a key component. And I don't know about you, Julian, I know you're a manual therapist, you're also a father, you're a family man, you're a member of a team. How does the breath show up for you when you're working, for example, on e-health?
I remember studying Qigong and martial arts and them talking about how important the breath was. And I didn't really understand it when I was younger. And for me, it was more recently with embodiment work and how our states of being are affected and can affect the breath, when it really clicked how important it was. So my focus more now is in embodied coaching, and before COVID running workshops in that kind of stuff. And how we can allow our change our state with our nervous system state and our energetic being state in presence. And how much, the interesting question came for me of how much can we allow the breath to support that and be moved by that and touched by that change and shift in, you could say, nervous system state or down regulation, or coming into a sense of safety and presence and co-regulation with a partner or a triad in a workshop. And then I really understood that that was directly linked to the breath. And if I could allow the breath to be touched and moved by that, that they were working together rather than one preventing the other from coming into being, basically. So
it's a bigger deal, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, big deal.
And this is where what the course is about is actually about simplifying and applying the knowledge that we'll develop in each class. But how do we get that so that we've got the common denominators that we can really be clear about and sort of, I hesitate to say this, but map it, given that it's a bit like the Marauders map in Harry Potter. I don't know if you're a Harry Potter fan, but there's a thing called the Marauders map that J.K. Rowling describes, and it's a living map, and you open the map and whoever's in the castle at the time, their footsteps are moving on the map. And I think of any map of the breath being used in a clinical setting as something of a Marauder's map. Not that it's a negative thing, quite the opposite, but it allows us to think, well, hang on a minute, whatever I'm measuring, whatever I'm assessing here, whatever I'm planning to treat here, what we have with the breath is, as you've said, a common denominator of every system of the body, because it's the symbol of life. And I think we can get our knickers in a knot over the breath, thinking that we can control it. That's one thing. And I think that one of the, if you like, the metaphors we can use is that somehow we think if we understand the science of it, the biomechanics and the physiology and the anatomy well enough, we'll be able to drill down on how to optimize the breath with the correct results on the graphs and the correct data coming out of the body. But the story I share with you, I was in Canada in 2012, I think. I might have the wrong year, but I was at the International Fascia Research Congress. And Helena Langevin, who is a much respected by me and everyone, obviously a researcher, was discussing a piece of research that they'd done with a porcine sample, in our world, a pig. And they were assessing respiratory function. And I was standing at the back of the room with my publisher, Serena Wolfard, with a coffee. And we were just having a coffee, you know, the coffee machines at the back of the room, and we were just standing chatting. And I just heard Dr. Langevin say something that I'm going to paraphrase because I can't remember the exact sentence. But it was an extremely complex, very carefully stated comment describing the erratic diaphragmatic response from the porcine sample that meant the inconsistency in the data was recognized for these parameters, and therefore they euthanized the porcine sample in order to extract or work out a more meaningful data, whatever. And it was all this very flat reporting, as they are obliged to do, of their scientific parameters and processes and deductions and so on. And I was standing next to Serena and I went, they killed the pig. And she said, what are you talking about? I said, they just said they killed the bloody pig. And she said, what are you talking about? And I said, they just didn't get the right data from its breathing. In a laboratory, it's a sentient creature, just saying the data didn't match the required outcome, so they killed the pig. Now, I'm not accusing Dr. Langevin of killing a pig, don't get me wrong. That's part of animal experimentation, and I'm not up in my arms about any of that. That's a separate thing. My point is, the data-based functioning of intellectual information doesn't necessarily give us the picture of what's going on. And if you've got a highly stressed animal moving, particularly if it involves something like a pig and a treadmill, how are you going to get you take my point. There is a human in humans being, and in animals, a sentient breath that cannot be usefully reduced to data if that's all we're looking for. I don't care which way you cut it. It's like putting a rat on the edge of the table with its claws on the edge of the table and pulling its tail and saying that's stretching. You're going to get a neuromuscular response from that animal to stop itself being pulled. It's a reflex. It's an intuitive and instinctive, a biomotional response, because creatures, living things, are bioemotional, not bioemotional, bioemotional. And what I mean by that is a claim that to reduce function to its biomechanical data-based limit is to describe the parts of a watch by its functional parameters of the parts. But that doesn't tell you how to assemble it, and it also doesn't tell the time. And I use that symbolically, and please don't anyone think I'm criticizing Helena Langevin's research. She is somebody I respect hugely and value hugely, the research that she's done into fascia. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that science or scientific data isn't always the be all and the end all. And I think there's far more to it. And when we're actually on the ground, on a yoga mat, in a classroom with people, on Zoom, teaching online, with our colleagues, with our friends, doing manual therapy, communicating, the common denominator of the interface between us is far more than the sum of the anatomical or biomechanical parts and their functions and their data. Now, having said that, it's difficult because you get fabulous data coming out when someone's really well. But I don't think we can just leave it at measured parameters. I think they're very useful tools, and we have to remember that that's all they are. I don't think they are the founding basis of the web. Should we put it like that?
I've got some questions for you, Joanne.
Have you?
Yeah, well, questions or reflections. You and John, John, I know specifically, has said many times about the hierarchy in the body.
Yeah.
And with this bioemotional common denominator, whether we're in a yoga studio or sat having a cup of tea, being one of them being the breath. And so one's this about the limit and boundary of the self and the breath and how it links us. And our Philip Shepherd has this thing that, you know, the breath comes out of the skin limit of the body, and we exchange in the oxygen and nitrogen, carbon dioxide with the trees.
Yeah.
And therefore our influence in that aspect of human life is extending beyond the skin boundary of the human body. But I'm interested also in this hierarchical aspect, because the control, like if we come into breath awareness, if we Philip Shepherd, our friend and colleague, has a very non-hierarchical, non-top-down control method of working with the breath, relaxing the body to the in-breath, relaxing the body to the out-breath, and diaphragms sinking and becoming aware of the pelvic diaphragm moving with the thoracic diaphragm and things like that. And then this other aspect of influencing and being influenced and being intimately linked to other breathing living things. But this returning to wholeness, you know, you said you can't map and lay out the parts of a watch and tell the time. You might be able to build a watch. So this living, breathing intelligence that can't be reduced and tested and understood in its wholeness, how the hierarchy, there's three, they're not questions, they're three aspects that fascinate me about the breath. Is one is it's not limited into like a bound system. The other is that it's intimately linked to our state of being and wellness. Kathy Dooley's doing a course at the moment on lymph, and she's talking about how important it is in lymph movement as one of the primary movers of lymph. And yeah, and one other aspect that I touched on there, linking us all and our sense of wholeness with our breath. And you say the figures that come out when you assess somebody who's well are very interesting. But as things start to maybe break down, you can't blame it on the breath, or breath can no longer perhaps be a good indicator of that person's state of health. So I'm wondering how, within a hierarchy, if we, where you put, you know, you can't put it somewhere on the hierarchy, I would imagine.
Well, it's a difficult question. Let's just clear up what we mean by hierarchy and use two other words that come in that I think are very useful distinctions. One of the things that happens in the biotensegrity field, where we talk about how things are all joined together in very particular ways and patterns, and the body is a response to tension and compression, or is a pre-stressed architecture that is a tension compression response, we often consider in the biotensegrity field that the body is what's called a heterarchical organization. So there's no top down, bottom up. There's this kind of level web playing field, if you will, where everything affects everything else, except that's not true. It's just not true. Your body will respond, and the breath is partly voluntary and partly involuntary. You can't suffocate yourself. You can kill yourself, but you can't suffocate yourself. And your breath will be one of a cascade of responses to either the environment or the perceived environment. And there is a hierarchical system built into you that dominates that as a life-preserving thing that intellectually you don't need to understand for it to take place. You haven't got time to think, oh, look, there's a fly coming straight for my eye and I've got my visor up and I'm on a motorbike. I know what I'll do. I'll have a little chat and then I'll shut my eyelid. You reflexively close your eye. Same as if you are, how many of you have commuted on trains and you're on the train and you're sitting there and you're getting sleepy and you drop your head and you do that. That is a neuromuscular reflex. And there are reflexes we can override. I used to participate with, and still I'm very close friends with, somebody who runs a school of baby swimming. And we work in a very specific way to prevent the baby from naturally losing its reflex to close its throat in water, because obviously it's grown in water for 9 months. And over the next 3 months after birth, it still keeps that reflex. And we teach it to keep that reflex. And I'm very lucky. I did it with my son when he was 6 weeks old, and it saved his life. He fell into a sink, and the tap was running, and his mouth just filled with water. It was an accident you couldn't have made up. He literally fell and twisted and lay there with his mouth filling up with water, and I sat him up, and he just went and spat it straight out like a frog. Now, there was no choking. He just looked at me as if to say, what was that all about? I mean, I can't, whatever.
Wow.
But there is a hierarchy to the response. So if you see a bus that you've got to run for and your life depends on you getting on that bus, you will immediately, your eyes will dilate, your digestive system, your parasympathetic, sympathetic balance will change, your breathing will speed up, and you'll leg it for the bus. I mean, it's not an either or. However, there's a third state that we can talk about. And I think you asked me or commented on several things. So I'm trying to sort of give a blanket distinction that something Ken Wilber calls an holarchic setup, a holarchy. So a holarchy means, for example, imagine that you're reading a book. Each word in that book, the word I, the word has a meaning. So each letter has its own meaning, and each letter in the alphabet is whole and complete in and of itself. And within a word, depending on how you use those letters and in what order you use them at the time, they form a word which is whole and complete within itself. And then that word is in a sentence, and the sentence is in a paragraph, the paragraph to the chapter to the book to the library to the buildings in the city to the country to the planet to the cosmos, and so on. So every single one of those is called an holarchic entity because it's whole and complete in and of itself. And when you consider that the body is multidimensional, that we have a physical aspect, we have an emotional aspect, we have a mental aspect, we have, let's say, an etheric or subconscious aspect, we have a spiritual aspect, we are mystical beings because we don't know most of it. We haven't got a clue. Not a clue. And we don't have to know, you know, an acorn doesn't have to go to university to learn oak treedom and get a PhD in order to grow into an oak tree. It's already, the oak tree's resident in the acorn. And we are, if you like, resident in potential, in the embryo, in the zygote, in the unicellular being that isn't unicellular for very long, let me add, but that, and that's Jaap van der Waal's distinction, that we multiply very, very rapidly and become who we are as part of the holarchy called life, called galaxies. And we can't imagine it because it's so huge. And yet at the same time, we're manifesting what's within us, the organelles to the cells to the organs to the organism to the organization, the organization to the organic planet, the organic planet to the galaxy to the galaxies. And we know there's millions of galaxies. And so one of the things I think we struggle with is that we want to categorize and distinguish the uncategorizable and the undistinguishable, because it's invisible, in order to understand it, which is completely commendable. Because the more we understand, the more we think we know, and the more we think we know, the better we think we are or capable of being, and the bigger difference we can make to each other. And what I think you're referring to also is this collective responsibility, and I use that word carefully, the ability to respond. And what fascinates me from a biotensegrity point of view is that every single one of us has a pre-stiffened architecture, which means we are a resonance field. And if I demonstrate my resonance field by raising the rhythm of my breath, Let's try it right now. I'll suddenly start talking very, very quickly, and I'm going to raise the rhythm of my breath so that I can talk much faster. And then I'm going to tell you lots and lots of things about the webinar that we're going to do next week, because it's going to be in three parts and we're going to do lots of practical things and it's very clinical. And and I'm talking too quickly, and obviously everybody's getting slightly agitated. Can Jo really talk that fast for that long? How long could she keep it up? Oh my God, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, thank God that's over. Now, I might have just given you the crown jewels of information, but the pace was inappropriate. And fascia is the organ of proprioception. They're the same root. And the root of proprioception and the root of appropriate is one's own. And it's a bit like a reflexive verb. We don't have them in England, but we can language them. That one's own self regulation, one's own self awareness, one's own self development, one's own self assembly, and we self assembled into form. And we already know how to breathe. And it's heterarchical and hierarchical, and thank God, holarchical, because trust me, the minute carbon or hydrogen or oxygen on this planet changes, we're all in trouble instantly. Instantly. So responsibility for me is the ability to respond, and the best we can do at the time is respond appropriately. The question is, who are we responding appropriately for? And primarily the breath brings us to a place where we have an interface with that responsibility, because it's not entirely involuntary. And it will take over involuntarily if we make a mess of it, largely. It's not always in our favour, but usually. Right. I don't know if that addresses some of that, but I'm saying yes, 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 no, both, neither, either, or.
Yeah. The notion, all those layers, the multi-dimensionality of the human being and the holarchical.
I will say one thing. I agree with, I love a lot of Philip Shepherd's work. And what we have is that wherever you're at, whichever holarchy you're on, you have to describe the scale. What I mean by that is, are we at the scale of the letters in the alphabet to the words they can form? Or are we at the scale of words to the paragraph? Or are we at the scale of paragraphs to chapters? Or have we assumed a sequence of chapters and we're looking at the scale of a book? Or are you a librarian, in which case you don't care about the content of all the books, you've just got to make sure that they're in the right order that somebody else can find the one they're looking for. So at all times, we're working on multiple scales. So too with the body. Now, the body is amazing. It is a magical mystery tour of incredibleness. It's awesome. And every aspect of it that we study reveals another aspect, or 5 million. Folding, protein folding. I mean, it's fascinating. The organization of chemicals, mechanotransduction, and how that communicates to that instantly. The breath response to what's going on, how we handle time, how we handle space. If a space is changed, look at my nostrils. If do that, or everybody that's on the webinar now, just get fingers on either side of your nostrils and push them in and try and breathe at the time. Something will happen if you're nasal breathing. So we've just changed the shape. All we did was that, and the breath changed. That was a physical response. Now I need a tissue. And everything changes, everything else. Sorry about that. And we're a time-space continuum. We can't get our heads around it. It's, I think the Buddhists say air to a bird, water to a fish is like being to a human. So every single aspect that we study is juicy, because this is so mystically, magically, magnificently detailed and complex and extraordinary that it's tolerant of every way that we use it or abuse it. So we can discuss anything, but what my point I wanted to make from what you said, because I didn't want to miss any aspect of what you said, was Philip talks about the skin. And what I'm saying to you is the skin is one boundary.
Mm.
The peritoneum is the boundary of the viscera. The pleura is the boundary of the lungs. The pericardial sac is the boundary of the heart. So those are the membranes. The skin is the boundary of the whole caboodle. Those are the membranes we're discussing, but the functionality is integrated. We're a collective, you like it or not. As you said, we exhale the gases that the trees inhale, we inhale the gases the trees exhale, and if that exchange goes out of balance, we'll all be sick.
Yeah, the part of the hierarchical question comes from this notion of retraining someone's breath. So in my webinar, I was acutely aware that maybe what I seemed to be saying, or what you could interpret from what I shared, was if somebody comes in, there are some ways to assess the breath, which there are.
Yes. But
then if we're the clever therapist, are we the librarian? Are we writing? Are we forming words? Are we forming paragraphs? You know, are we understanding the lesson and the session above the session, and have humility that we're also learning and we also don't know? And, you know, this treatment model or coaching model and the person-centeredness. So I think this course you're going to do, and what I would like to unpack from my webinar, and hopefully you'll be part of the unpacking, is I'm sure you will, is that, you know, to assess someone and then to tackle it with breath first as a hierarchical, because in Liam's research and the research he read, he said something like 70% of people walk in with some kind of breathing pattern disorder.
Yes, I think he's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he's saying what we say in yoga, really, is that there is a common denominator. And what I think the invitation is here in any practice session that has to be client-centered is that, and I have this conversation in yoga all the time, we don't adjust postures, we adjust people.
Mm.
And we use the postures as a framework, we use the postures as a reference, that's fine. But don't make the person right or wrong because they could fit the posture. That's bonkers in my world. So I'm with Leon completely. I probably think it's higher than 70%. I err on the side of non-interference because I've seen trauma induced through timing the breath, insisting on particular breathing exercises done very intensely, and also imposing breathing rhythms. Mm. Because the fascial matrix is like a liquid crystal memory bank. It's a moving silicon fluid chip. And as such, it retains or holds memory. And when we say the issue's in the tissue, like someone just discovered that, it's like, well, where else is it going to be? I mean, come on. You haven't got a box in your head that somebody opens, like an airplane black box, and they get out. It's here. It's everywhere. It's in the matrix. And as such, when we work with common denominators, you might say the way the feet greet the ground is a common denominator of yoga. And I think in any practice, the breath is a very powerful common denominator among many, but it's one of the key ones. Mm. And I was talking to Michael Shea earlier today, and he's the father of a whole cranial treatment and heart-centered cranial work. Absolutely wonderful, wonderful man. And he was saying the heart rhythm and the heart health and the breath are so intimately related. How can you not be talking about both of them at the same time? And John Sharkey describes the cardiorespiratory system because it's they just can't be distinguished. But what I'm hoping we can do is encourage people to study different breath techniques. The particular one I'm going to show you, I'm going to show you an assessment and a technique in the course that are, in one way, they're embarrassingly simple, but that's why they're so useful, because what I found over the last 20 years of teaching them, that's not true, I haven't taught them for 20 years because I developed them out of the first 10 years, but I found certainly in the last 10 years teaching them as a structural integration teacher and a movement teacher, yoga teacher, that they're very, very simple, and the reference they are their own reference. So in other words, they don't replace or remove the need for the wonderful data that your webinar justified the purpose of. That's what was so brilliant about it. It explained why you take the data that you take. This is more a proprioceptive feedback that's very, very simple. But it's for the client and the practitioner to register somatic change as what we could call a somatosensory interface, which is a posh way of saying they feel it and you feel it very quickly and very readily. Mm. And so what you've done effectively is validate the work of the session and given them a mechanism, a measure that is very soft, very non-invasive, very easy to recognize, so that they can simply put, feel the difference. You know, I sound like an advert for ketchup, you know, taste the difference. But I think we need that as human beings. We need feedback to know that our sensory output and our sensory input and our whatever our reasons for going to another practitioner or a friend or a relative or a child, you know, I mean, you know, when your child is upset and you go to comfort them, you immediately go for a comforting gesture. And if the child pushes you away, there's another level of distress added that you don't know what to do next. And what this does is it very quietly and very neutrally and in a very nuanced way, and you get more nuanced as you do it, because the more you do it, because it's so simple, the more nuanced the technique becomes. You have this soft, quiet repertoire of information, and the client can actually do it on themselves as well. So in these COVID times when we're working online, I've had clients self-assess and do these techniques and then self-assess. And it literally just gives us a quiet measure, because we're not trying to change the world, we're easing breathing, and that actually can change the world. If you, as you know, if you come across somebody who is paradoxically breathing, for example, as a daily function rather than as a very specialized situation, which is probably what triggered it, but if they haven't let go of that, there needs to be a pattern interrupt, and there's very particular ways we show a technique in this course of very, very gently and lovingly and appropriately dealing with paradoxical breathing, most easily done one-to-one. I must say it's not I haven't tried it online. I haven't had anybody paradoxically breathing that I've had to deal with online yet, which doesn't mean we couldn't adapt it. It means I haven't adapted it.
Fantastic. We had a webinar on the treatment cycle, and Carol Davis, who's here live with us tonight.
Hi, Carol.
She was talking about, and I'm smiling a lot inside to this and looking forward to what you're going to share on that, because these gentle inquiries that breed curiosity and integration and biofeedback updates about our reality somatically are so important to tracing. The webinar was about the treatment cycle and how to move people into integration, satisfaction, relaxation, and then move on to the next priority. But if we fixate on someone's breathing, then, and we try to change it as the clever therapist, then we're not honoring the self-intelligent organizing principle of their emotional or their
it's
life.
It's hard, isn't it? It's really hard. I have this conversation with my colleagues that teach yoga. We all want to teach everybody Kapalabhati and Nadi Sadani and all these different Ujjayi breaths and the different qualitative ways of learning breathing techniques in yoga. It's a big thing, pranayama. But there's also a big misunderstanding. A lot of people think that prana stands for energy, life force, prana with a capital P, and yama, which means ways, the yamas and the niyamas, the eight limbs of yoga, the yamas and the niyamas, the ways and niyamas, the personal ways. And the implication of yama is control. So you have these ways of controlling the body. And some of that myth arose even further when many of the breathing exercises done in yoga were originally focused on ways of young boys handling their development from childhood into adolescence through puberty, and managing their desires and their excitement and being able to manage and self-regulate them, their impetuosity and their excitement and their burgeoning sexuality with breath control. So it became the idea that pranayama is breath control, pranayama, but that's not accurate. Ayama, A-Y-A-M-A, actually means expansion. So pranayama is the expansion of life force. Mm. And in the mystery schools, which is where I really live, expansion is the signal of inner awareness. That instead of a feeling of contraction and fear and extraneous tension and inappropriate concern and worry and anxiety, that one allows expansion into spirit or into whatever you call nature or grace or Atman, the respiration, the animation of life force, prana, and you expand and allow it. Now, of course, that has a cascade effect. It is hierarchical. The minute you relax all of this, which includes the vagus nerve, obviously, which includes the tongue, which is part of the breathing orchestra, which includes the heart and the lungs and the upper body and the diaphragm, and includes the reflecting diaphragms, i.e. the pelvic floor, and then the sub-diaphragms, the subtle diaphragms, the feet, the hands. Where doesn't it include? It doesn't, it includes everything. So anybody can make a claim, I think, that, you know, I study the lymphatic system and it's a very important aspect of yoga. I'm in the circulatory system. It's very, sorry, not yoga. A breath is a very important part of it. And breath's an important part of everything. No breath, no life, period. That's not complicated. That's not a discovery. What I am fascinated by is if there are some softer, more neutral techniques. Mm-hmm. That can invite this nuanced awareness. And I hope I'm providing one of them in the course. And one of the things Michael was saying to me today was that he, for years, has done yoga. I hope you won't mind me sharing this, that recently he stopped going to yoga over recent years because I presume the zealous excitement, and I don't know where he is that he's doing it, but he was getting injured. And he said, what is it about young people and yoga today? And I don't know if it's just that we're all entering our senior years. I have no idea how old he is, but he's certainly old enough to be very wise and highly respected doctor of embryology. And I mean, the man's a genius. I just can't even tell you. It's heaven talking to him. Yeah. And I just feel that we need to kind of settle back and think about what I'm calling bumper sticker anatomy, bumper sticker promotion of these ideas, and just soften into how the body actually works as a whole, acknowledging. I mean, I'm not going to talk about the lymphatic system next week. I'm not going to talk about I will talk a bit about the musculoskeletal system, so-called, but I'm not going to talk about the endocrine system particularly, but am I going to affect them with some of the movements and assessments and ideas that we put across? Of course, because if you're working with the breath, you're working with everything. And when I say this word bioemotional, it doesn't exist in the English dictionary. I made it up because I got so fed up with being told I had no right to say that there are no levers in non-linear biologic forms. Just let me tell you, there's no levers in non-linear biologic forms. None. We're not puppets. I don't care how many degrees you've got in biomechanics. There are no levers in non-linear biologic forms, period. And we are non-linear biologic forms. So non-linearity gives rise to something called roundness. And roundness is the description of the breath. The breath is round. just saying. So it abides by different rules to linear musculoskeletal biomechanical function. Therefore, I call it the bioemotional breath, because this beautiful thing, any of you that don't have a Hoberman sphere on your desk, get one. This is the model of the breathing body. And if you have one, it's mesmerizing, because the body just, I don't know what happens, but I just find if I sit here moving this quickly and I move it slowly, it actually somehow, good man, it somehow resonates, and I just can calm. It's a thing. So I think we have to also include a little bit of a conversation about resonance and frequency and wholeness and bioemotional integrity is actually what I talk about, because bioemotional integrity is the kind of the spring-loaded ability to be who you are archetypally. So if you've got the bioemotional integrity of a cat, yes, a leopard, it's going to lie completely chilled out in the sun. It's going to hang off a branch with its arms hanging either side and its legs hanging either side and its tail hanging somewhere swinging in the breeze. And it's just going to be seriously, you know, chilled. And then when it's hunting, everything stiffens and it moves stealthily and it runs at very, very high speed. And it's archetypally, it's got a breathing pattern that matches its bioemotional archetypal patterning. Now, if you take a springbok, which would be chased by the cheetah, springbok very rarely lies down. When it does, it folds its limbs in such a way that it can literally ping into standing faster than you can watch it. And even as a newborn, a springbok, it has to stand immediately, and it springs. They practice springing on the spot just for fun. And of course, what they do when these two bioemotional archetypes meet each other in the field with such different movement signatures is that the cheetah, with its long, beautiful, waving stride, when it can run up to 60, 70 miles an hour, it can't keep it up for very long. And because of the speed, its trajectory is reasonably wide sweeps. Where, of course, the springbok can spring in midair and turn and change direction. And that's how it saves its own life, if it does, is this bioemotionally archetypal movement stroke breathing pattern that it can spring up in the air and ping and turn midair and go the other way. And the cheetah can't change direction as fast as the springbok. So the cheetah starts wearing itself out trying to reduce its turning circles to keep up with the springbok. And that's how they are not easy breakfast, because the timing of their rhythmical, archetypal breath in motion patterns, their bioemotional integrity is completely different. But that one of them is food for the other. One of them's higher up the food chain. And that's hierarchical. You will never find a springbok trying to eat and chase a cheetah for breakfast. It ain't going to happen. And one dappy springbok, I tell you. Do you know what I mean? So I get a bit antsy with this idea that heterarchy elbows hierarchy out the door, because this is the new, you know, give me a break. They're both true. They're both valuable. And they're both unique and great. And who, like a jellyfish, what's like a jellyfish, Katie? I don't know.
I think the Hoberman sphere expanding and
contracting. Oh yeah, this is like a jellyfish, yeah. I mean, this is how we breathe. This is how a jellyfish breathes. And of course, great. And they're responding in bioemotional integrity with the water, because if they don't, they get swept ashore. And one of the most beautiful things you can ever see, if anyone gets a chance to see this, do this. I once had reason to take my son to La Gomera. Once in my life, we had 5 weeks. Oh my God, I haven't had a holiday in years, but this was just really special. We took 5 weeks and we went to La Gomera and we watched the dolphins and whales come in the spring to breed. And you're not allowed in the water with them, but you get to watch them. And because we were there for so long, and because, I don't know why, my son just seemed to draw the dolphins. So the boatmen loved him. So they wanted us to go out with them every time. And what you see when you meet these boatmen, and now we're back to the watch, really, because when you meet a craftsman who builds a watch, it's something, it's a skill beyond putting the parts together and writing a manual. It's something else. There's something very, very special about this, a beautiful timepiece that's been hand-constructed. It's another world of skill and craftsmanship. And I think we're crafting our lives. So it's not enough to just have the names of the parts. Another thing. But every single one of these dolphins has a movement signature. And the boatmen read the species by the way they leap out of the water. So the spinners come up and spin, they're fairly obvious. But the bigger ones, the porpoises and the bottlenose dolphins and the small pilot whales, they all have these very different movement signatures. And the boatmen can read the water and they read these movement patterns on the horizon. But it gets better. They know when there's whales around and they know what size of whale from their tail prints. I mean, just think about that. The tail is in the water and the animal may be tens of feet below the surface, but that tail fluke moving leaves a shape in the sea. And if the conditions are right, if the conditions aren't right, the boats won't be out there. But if the conditions are right, they can actually read not only which species of whale they're watching, but they can tell the, let me just write this for somebody's asked what, it's called a Hoberman's sphere. No, it's trying to correct me to Dobermans. Don't correct me. I keep having my spell checked. The tail print designates literally which whale, but it also the patterns in the tail print. We were out with somebody called Bent, and he used to know what the whales were doing. He could tell by the patterns whether they were hungry and therefore we left them alone because they were hunting. Or on one occasion, I'll never forget as long as I live, he said there's two babies and three mothers, there's a nursery school. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he said, come here. And he showed me these interlocking tail fluke patterns. And he said, that means there's three mothers acting as guardians around two babies. And his wife was on the boat, and she said, let Joe hang off the boat. So I hung by my ankles. I was held by my ankles and I went into the water just up to here, but upside down. You see what I mean? With a snorkel and a mask, holding my breath. And I saw there was a sunbeam and these three mother whales were moving slowly down this sunbeam to the ocean floor. And these two babies were in between them and they were just circling them in a cone shape to keep them protected, but to keep them dancing down this sunbeam. And I mean, I was holding my breath, but I would have been holding my breath if I could have breathed. And when they pulled me back into the boat, I would never forget Bernd's wife, Melanie. She put her arms around me and she looked at my son and she said, Ben, you must leave mommy very, very quiet for a bit because she's going to go into a deep trance. She needs to rest. And she literally, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. I was gone. And she laid me down on the boat and put a sarong over me. And she said, you just stay there and breathe because you are in a trance. You've been zapped. Mm. They zapped me. And I didn't know what I was in for, but she did. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. I think I wrote to some people on my phone, I've died and woken up in heaven. I'll never forget this. And what I remember was that for the whole subsequent, the rest of that holiday, I saw colours more clearly. I saw the sea more brightly. I saw my life so clearly. It was so clear. It was just as if someone had repainted it for me and said, this is it right now. This is all there is. And that was all there was to get. And I cannot tell you the exquisite grace of that. And in that moment, my breath was their breath. There was no distinction. There was no discussion. There was nothing to describe it with. Words weren't. There's a beautiful Wittgenstein poem, and it goes, one of the lines in it is, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent.
Beautiful.
Thank you, Katie. Deeply magnificent. It was deeply magnificent. I love that. It was deeply magnificent. Oh, Rachel's here. Oh, my God.
What I'm hearing, Joanne, is, and I'm really happy, is that the three-part series is going to be a way for us to explore the breath as a way of coming into co-resonance and reverence of the intelligence of the body and handling it the way you've described it.
That's beautifully put. Did you say that or did you read that from somebody?
No, I just...
You just said that. It's beautiful. Co-resonance and reverence. Oh!
Katie, on the who's speaking there, she and I have this, she developed it. Like you, after 10 years of practice, the next 10 years she developed what she calls body poem. And I'm privileged to be offered to co-teach it with her. And we're doing facilitator trainings in that. And it's that's why I just messaged her about half an hour ago and said, you must jump on this. Because her approach is very much listening to the intelligence and the self-emerging organizing principle of the body, and to work with the breath to do that as well. These are all lovely ways. And we're writing a new website for it. So
I'm very excited. I'd love to play with you.
Yeah, we'd love to. And Carol, we're exploring a whole load of lovely ideas on mecha transduction and things and forming something exciting in collaboration with all of you lovely people. Let's play. Woo!
Yeah, I love this. Carol's written, this at oneness is described by Maslow as a true peak experience, a term diluted, unfortunately, from the pure splendor of the moment. Absolutely. Well, in the Jewish faith, we have the Day of Atonement, which I think was quite recently. And when I was a little girl, I used to go to the synagogue with my dad, and they wouldn't let me fast. You fast all day and they wouldn't let me. I was very cross. Till I was 9, I was allowed to fast. And I used to go into the synagogue with him, and he would wear his prayer shawl, and I would sit for absolutely hours on end braiding his prayer shawl. And I was very, very cross they wouldn't let me fast. And by the time I was 9, they did. And it was a day of atonement is what it was called. And we were told we had to atone for our sins, and we had to think about all the people that didn't have as much as we had, and feel grateful for what we had. And then when I developed my own spiritual studies, I was given the idea that actually it was a day of at-one-ment, where I could be at one with everybody, uncluttered and distracted, if you like, by eating and sitting at table and doing what you do in a normal day. And we just had this opportunity to sit quietly in prayer. And I think I was quite young when I started to wonder why we did it. And I absolutely loved, never forget, as long as I live, that after 24 hours of fasting, when my grandmother made chopped herring sandwiches and tea, that the tea never tasted the same for the rest of the year as the first cup of tea after you'd fasted for 24 hours. And I, even as a child, thought that it somehow gave you this feeling of grace that was the first cup of tea you'd had, and that there was this honouring. And I think what happens when we remember the breath and bring ourselves back to the breath, or let the breath bring us back to ourselves, we can kind of be in the next moment with a newness. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
To me. I think we almost have to say it quietly.
I'm wondering, Joe, we should stop soonish, although I don't want to stop. The Visa Capices, sure you brought it up in the Sacred Geometry webinar, which you should check out. And I think I was talking to Carol Davis about this, but you know the Christian notion of if two people meet in my name, I am there.
Yes.
I've been having a recurrent felt sense about that, about if we bring our awareness, the two people, the client and the practitioner, or it can be a practitioner and a practitioner, or two monks or whoever, bring their awareness together, perhaps with joint intention or clear agreement and clear purpose, there's a third organizing. It was in your webinar, definitely.
It was in my webinar, yeah.
Third organizing, there's becomes this third entity. And I also interviewed a few people about art and about calligraphy and different arts. And if calligraphy becomes one of the spheres and it's just you and the calligraphy brush and the piece of paper, but the intention and the artistic expression is the calligraphy, again, there's this merging, like you were with the whales, and there's a non-separation in this glue of overlapping this. This is something I'm fascinated by.
Well, it's a fundamental part of ancient wisdom of the teachings of the Christ. When two or more are gathered in my name, there is this coming together of two different things that united form a third thing. And that pattern of the Visa Capiscis or the Visa Capiscis, whichever you call it, if you draw around that and just continue it very slightly, that shape is called, in Christian symbolism, it's called the bladder of the Christ. And it's actually considered to be a dolphin. And it's a keystone in biotensegrity, funnily enough, though God help me if anybody accuses me of taking biotensegrity into the realm of religion, I will get shot, because I don't really, I'm not religious. I have a strong spiritual practice, but it's beyond, I don't care about race, creed, color, religion, circumstance, environment, condition, whatever. It's everything. And that is that the when two or more gather in my name, so can amazing things arise. And that's where the idea of Father, Mother, God comes from, that the Father and the Mother come together and the child is the child of God. It's the result, the sum total of the two becomes three. And that's what happens in biotensegrity. It's the foundation of biotensegrity, that attentional force, when in an appropriate pattern, geometric, of a compression force, they co-create each other. So when you have a model like this, which is actually a model of the breath, that you have the, we see this in a tensegrity model as a separate tension wire, if you can see it, from the compression strut. But in the human body, of course, they're not separate. It's one fabric, not two. As John Sharkey says, there's no knot in the fabric. This has to have a knot in the fabric, and these are separate. But in the body, bones are not separate from the tissue of cartilage around them. They arose from cartilaginous tissue. They're the hardening and the calcium deposits from cartilaginous tissue responding to forces. Excuse me. So each one of these, if they're in an appropriate pattern, co-creates the other, and it correlates with the other. So we have tension and compression creating tension compression. So when two or more gather in my name, i.e. gather in consciousness, consciously gather, we animate this consciously. The consciousness brings two or more things gathered together, tension compression, as an architecture. What we have is the architect self-assembling the architecture through which to express the architect. It's supposed to do your head in, because this is beyond reason. And we bring ourselves back to the beginning. If we reduce all our understanding of breathing to reasoning and data, we cheat ourselves of the grandeur and the splendor and the magnificence of our own self-assembly. Because technically we will say things like, well, embryos can't breathe, the fetus doesn't breathe. we take our first breath when we're born. That is nonsense. That is nonsense. It's simply breathing a different way. It practices breathing movements. Breath animation is round and breath is everywhere. And when I've worked with particularly healthy clients, I can feel their breathing. It's like I'll touch the body in a craniosacral way, not but the whole body. And you can feel the breathing where the breathing's missing. Does that make sense? Like one ankle feels like it's not breathing. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So for me, the breath is a sense. Mm. It's a sensory mechanism as well. And I love what Mariel said. When treating a person, you also can get in a sort of coherent breathing with your client and some sort of flow together. Exactly. And this is how we actually soothe our babies when we have new babies, is we naturally rhythmically rock them. We instinctively do that and we breathe with them and gradually they soften and they come into our own breathing pattern. Mm. And I'll tell you another story before we go about an animal. I had my beautiful Irish red setter. Did you meet Sasha? You did,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God, she was the most beautiful animal in the world. And I went away when I wrote my book. I went away for 2 months to get it written. And when I got back, my son phoned me and said, I'm going to come and pick you up from the station, Mum, with the dog, because she'll be so thrilled to see you. And I arrived at the station and he let the dog go to run down the steps to me and she ran straight past me. I can't even tell you. I was devastated. And I got hold of her and I was like, are you serious? And she just looked around like she didn't know who I was. Like I'd been wiped from her memory. Really? Now, this dog was a character and a half. I mean, literally. I once gave her a cup of tea. I had a blue mug and I gave her a cup of tea because she loved tea. And she went like this, turned her head away. And I said, what's the matter with you? And it was Earl Grey. And I went, oh, sorry. And I went, you're not supposed to give dogs tea, by the way, but she loved tea. So very occasionally we did. So anyhow, so I made her another cup of tea and I handed it to her. And she sniffed it and then she just looked at me, but she wouldn't drink it. Wouldn't even take a lap. I was like, Sasha, are you for real? And I looked, I said, don't tell me you don't like the blue mug. I said, really? And she looked at me as if to say, well, you don't drink out of blue mugs. I've got a thing about white china. So I said, okay. And I went back and I stood there and I tipped the blue mug of tea that wasn't Earl Grey into the white mug and I handed it and she drank it. I mean, that's who my dog was. So she knew that she was ignoring me. And we got home and I said to Ben, I don't know what to do with this animal. And he said, she just won't speak to you. She laid down with her back to me. She was beside herself. And she got into her chair and she sat up. Well, not her chair was an armchair. It was the most expensive chair in the house, of course. And she sat up in the armchair with her head over the back of the chair, looking away from me. So I could sit in the chair next to her, but I couldn't. She wouldn't respond. And I thought, oh my God, I am in so much trouble with this dog. It's unbelievable. So I wrapped my arms around her like this. And she had her head over my shoulder looking away. And she was pulling away from me like this, the whole like this. And I breathed. And I thought, I don't know what to do. And I just breathed. And I breathed. And I breathed. And I leaned into her and I breathed with her. And I breathed some more. And it's not a word of a lie. I spent 40 minutes breathing with this dog till we both dropped into this meditative role. I mean, roll, like as in rolling water. It was like waves. I just still had both my arms around her. I had my whole body against hers, leaning into the back of the chair. And then she lifted her head off my shoulder and she put her head down. I swear to God, you don't have to believe me, but a tear rolled out of her eye and all the way down her nose and splashed onto my lap. And I just looked at her, I said, oh my God, I've broken your heart. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And I just stroked her and I breathed with her. And I was forgiven eventually. But that's exactly what it took. Everything that Mariel has just written there is exactly, I wouldn't it's like Carol said earlier, calling it coherent breathing is a way of referencing it. And the last thing I was thinking was coherent breathing. All I was thinking as I was holding that animal was, I love you, I'm sorry, please forgive me. Literally breathing it. I love you, please forgive me, I'm sorry, over and over and over and over. And after that, she wouldn't leave my side. She wouldn't leave my side. And I never left her again.
That's similar to that prayer, that Ho'oponopono, whatever it is.
The, yeah. Hawaii. Thank you, I love you. What is it? Thank you, I love you. Please forgive me, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
exactly that.
I'll just tell people the dates of your course, Joanne. And Carol's written something there. You can maybe read it while I read these dates. So Joanne's course begins on the 2nd of November. The second part is on the 9th of November. And the third part on the 16th. And these are Monday nights. And also, Joanne was talking about the movement resonance in the water of different sea mammals. And I can't not mention a course that starts tomorrow, Joanne. I know this webinar is about your course.
No, fine, go ahead.
Which is Vicky Davis. She's an evolutionary, she's studying evolutionary biology, and she's a structural integrator. And she's got a course starting tomorrow. It's 10:30 in the morning. And it is on our evolving body. And she's studied the movement patterns and made masks of the different evolutionary landmarks of our evolution. And the movement patterns and this dolphin midline movement, sagittal and the horizontal, it's fascinating. And our perception of time. So that's going to be an amazing course. The webinar's up for people to check out, the free one. And of course... it's all related, breath, movement, evolution.
Love it.
Awesome.
And time and timing are key. So we'll talk about that next week as well. So it's 2 weeks' time, isn't it? I can't wait. 2nd, 9th and 16th of November.
That's it. Yeah. And you.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. I wanted to share a really brief story as well, Joanne. Katie was at my house today, actually. And a friend of mine, Peter Littlejohn Cook, he was trained by Leonard Orr in breath work. And he was meditating in the Algarve, south of Portugal, on his family's farm. And there was lots of trees. They grew avocados there. And so maybe, I don't know what kind of trees he was sat among, but he was meditating deeply and doing his breath practice. And he became aware of this swooping feeling, like a dip and a rise, really like you were saying, the impala or the other men.
Springbok.
Is like a pattern interrupt to the cheetah who's on this different frequency of movement.
Yeah.
And so he sensed some other movement pattern in his field. And then he got a glimpse of himself sat there from a height. And he opened his eyes and there was a crow or some bird flying tree to tree at the rhythm that he'd been feeling in his nervous system. And he witnessed himself through...
the crow's eyes.
Yeah, the crow's eyes and a different nervous system. And I had a similar feeling, like you said, you felt at one with the whales. I was at the being gathering and I'd been working really hard, and I went to this being gathering with my family. And after a few days, my nervous system had really calmed down, and I walked to go get some food. And there was a clearing, and two hippies, because it was a hippie festival, walked towards each other. I didn't know, they were very tanned. They could have been from anywhere. I didn't know what language they might speak or who they were or what they were going to say. But as I walked towards them and they walked towards each other, I knew that they were going to speak English. I knew what they were going to say. I knew what one person was going to say, how they were going to respond. And I was witness to a non-linear unfolding of nervous system co-attunement, like he was with the bird.
Yeah.
And he told me that story, I think, that summer. And it kind of all came together in a painting dots painting kind of way, where I was like, whoa, they're, you know, that they are another you, you're another me. Whew. So
there's a lovely book by Deepak Chopra. Well, it says it's by Deepak Chopra. I don't know if he wrote it, but maybe he did. It's a novel. It's a story called The Return of Merlin. And it's all about crow mind. And it's very brilliant because it's this idea that there is a universal mind, and this relates to the Jungian archetypes as well, the collective consciousness, and that we can return to crow mind in our awareness as a sort of a neutral state from which we can look down on our individual personality oriented behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
I just, it's a lovely story of that. It's called The Return of Merlin, and it's very clever. It's very cleverly set in a modern England where this the character is a policeman who's King Arthur, and it's very funny, and it's about bending time and the future from the future and all that. Anyway, I have to go now, my darlings. Big love to everybody.
Thank you so much for this hour, Joanne, and everybody for joining us. Thank you for contributing with your questions and your co-resonant breathing.
And I'll see you on the 2nd of November.
2nd of November, yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Joe.
Bye, John.
Bye. Bye.